All right, we are underway. And that music means it's time. Oh, wrong show. Good evening. You're listening to Jazz After. This is Album of the Week. I'm Don Shore. Wait, what show are we on here?
Oh, my goodness. You are listening to That's Life. And I'm Lois Richter. I'm your host. I am talking with Don Shore, who is the co-host with me on the Davis Garden Show. And we love to have fun. And that's why you heard that strange opening. Really. Really, this is That's Life. It really is. And we'll keep that in the program.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. Yeah.
So I asked Don to come and be on my show just because I needed somebody to come and be on my show. It's been a while since I've done things. Yeah. I just did a recording with Preacher. In fact, it should have shown the week before this one's going out.
Cool.
Preacher is a local DJ who does a program called Praise Time with Preacher. And he does gospel music. And I was talking to him about gospel and what that is. And boy, was I wrong in my definitions. So listen to that show with Preacher and find out about gospel
music. Also, he's not a preacher. That's his nickname.
That's his name.
His name, yes.
Name.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great show.
Preacher Cleveland.
Yep.
All right. But this show, I asked Dom to come on and talk to me about jazz, because, you know, he does that Jazz After Dark show every week, mm-hmm. Which is 2 hours of music. It's amazing.
No, it's only 1 hour. It's only 1 hour.
It repeats.
Ah, see, that's true. That's true. Yes, it repeats. It's also available by podcast, Jazz After Dark. And this is an interesting fact. We now know that people are listening to it in small numbers, but are listening to it all over the world. We have the analytics that tell us what countries people were tuning in. And before that changed, we had just gone over 100 countries where people were somehow listening to Jazz After Dark from this little tiny radio station in Davis, California.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Yeah. The Davis Garden Show also has a wide listenership, I guess you'd call it.
Worldwide, yes. Worldwide listenership.
So I wanted to talk to Don about jazz, and it got me intrigued by, is gospel jazz? Is jazz gospel? How those two relate? So then I thought, well, now, what is jazz? I'm going to ask Don that question. But I did my homework, and I did some reading, and I Googled it. I got some definitions. So the first one is from Oxford Languages Dictionary, and it says, jazz, a type of music of African-American origin characterized by improvisation, syncopation, and usually a regular or forceful rhythm, emerging at the beginning of the 20th century. Brass and woodwind instruments and piano are particularly associated with jazz, although guitar and occasionally violin are also used. Styles include Dixieland, swing, bebop, and free jazz, which is a mix of folk, jazz, blues, and pop. That's one definition.
Dictionary definition. Yeah, that's a pretty old school definition there.
Yeah. I'm going to go through all of these before you get your say. So the next one is from Merriam-Webster. And what is jazz? American music developed especially from ragtime and blues and characterized by propulsive syncopated rhythms, polyphonic ensemble playing, varying degrees of improvisation, and often deliberate distortions of pitch and timbre.
I agree. That's a good one. Yep.
That's a good one. Okay. And then Wikipedia has a very long article about jazz. I encourage everyone to go look at that. And they say jazz is a music genre which originated in the African-American communities of New Orleans, Louisiana, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, with its roots in blues and ragtime. Since the 1920s jazz age, it has been recognized as a major form of musical expression in traditional and popular music. The parent genres are blues, ragtime, folk music, guitar mashing, and work song. The derivative forms, so the children of jazz, are rock and roll, rock, jump blues, traditional pop, reggae, rhythm and blues, ska, funk, hip-hop, house, neo-soul, and lounge. All right. One more. And this is from the New York Jazz Workshop. I figured they got to know. I mean, they're in the business of teaching people jazz. So it says, every style of jazz is played all around the world today, and two qualities that make it truly distinctive are improvisation and attention to staying in the present. Additionally, what? Jazz music, Additionally, jazz music, while absorbing influences from many genres, maintains its identity as jazz.
Okay, that's an interesting
I think
one.
That attention to staying in the present is that every time you play it, you have the opportunity to modify it a little bit.
Yeah, improvisation is the key theme that goes through that all, and that is absolutely a characteristic of jazz. It's rarely played directly from a score, although they may provide a score and have an arrangement. The musicians tend to improvise. One thing I will say about jazz musicians from the very beginning of jazz is they stole shamelessly from every other genre that was out there. So whatever else music was there became incorporated into jazz, because jazz musicians would try anything, and that was different than any other genre at the time. So I actually have one. Go ahead.
I have one more, and this is okay. From Ole Miss, which is Mississippi University.
Oh, there we go.
They teach about jazz too. Mm-hmm. Jazz is distinctively American style of music that developed in the early decades of the 20th century. Its roots include many Afro-American folk music traditions, such as spirituals, work songs, and blues. It also borrows from 19th century band music and the ragtime style of piano playing.
Yes.
Okay, so those are the definitions. Now, here's my question to you, Don. Is jazz jazz because of the beat or rhythm or style of playing, or is it jazz because of the people who did it?
Yes. The answer to your question is yes. Improvisation being the key thing among the things you're talking about there. I've dug through all those definitions and found one that I thought was really interesting from American heritage of all places. Jazz, born in that sociological gumbo pot New Orleans, is a multi-complexioned commingling of European concert music, brass band marches, African strains, and Latin tinges. It is, in other words, the perfect expression of the hodgepodge, the stew that is American culture. Stanley Crouch was a legendary jazz critic, quite acerbic and known for his commentary in the 1950s and 60s. He actually only died a couple years ago. He would say that there were certain things jazz had to have, or else you couldn't call it jazz. He got into pretty notable fights with some pretty leading jazz musicians like Miles Davis about, you can't just put out an album of music and call it jazz. It has to have something that defines it that way. And the things that he identified were that Latin tinge, the African origin, the European phrasing sometimes that is in there. It's all of those things. It's not one. It didn't just come from blues. It didn't just come from ragtime. All those things are in there. And if your music doesn't have some of those things, it's music. But you can't just call anything jazz. And he got into pretty vigorous disputes with people about this. But improvisation is one of the very key things. And historically, just very briefly, the first jazz musician is generally identified as a gentleman named Buddy Bolden, who there are no recordings surviving of his music. But he played the cornet, he was in New Orleans, and he took ragtime, but gave it a New Orleans style. What that means is that ragtime, which most people know nowadays from the works of Scott Joplin, popularized by Joshua Rifkin in the 1970s, is a chamber music style, really. It has a formal sound to it. You did play from sheet music, and it has a distinctive, actually rather European style. He took that and put a New Orleans emphasis on it. Speed it up, slow it down, change the time signature, improvise. You can dance to it. You're not going to sit there in a chamber music format and just listen to it. You're going to get up and dance. And he was the first one that did that. And an easy year to remember is 1900, because that's roughly when his band was popular at its peak in New Orleans, from about 1900 to about 1907. He basically, as they say in Wikipedia, created a looser, more improvised version of ragtime and added blues. So his band was the first that had brass instruments playing the blues. He adapted ideas from gospel music that he heard in the Baptist churches around the African-American communities in New Orleans, and that was the beginning of jazz. And within a decade or so, many other musicians were playing jazz, and also the recording industry came along, and records were put out. The recording industry was up in Chicago, so a lot of those musicians had to go up the river, the Mississippi, to Chicago in order to record music, and those are some of the first recording artists are Louis Armstrong, who people know, and others like that.
Well, you said one of the the essential things on jazz is improvisation.
Yes.
But when you record it, there is no more improvisation. Every time you play that record, it sounds exactly the same. So are you saying that I haven't actually heard jazz unless I've had a live performance of someone?
The next time that same band plays that same song, they'll play it differently. They don't follow an absolute score, typically. They do improvise. And the early jazz, most people know New Orleans jazz. Dixieland is the variant people typically know. New Orleans jazz bands were one, walking through the streets, not sitting in one place. It was a moving thing. They were all playing at the same time. They were improvising around a common melody, typically, and of course that propulsive bass beat so that they could walk at the same pace. They would never sound the same twice. That would be a key characteristic of it. But when it was recorded, yes, the recording was a frozen moment in time, and that same song recorded by the same group a year later would sound different. So improvisation really is a key characteristic of jazz, and a sign of a very good jazz musician is the ability to improvise within the parameters that have been set. Of course, they have arrangements. Of course, there is sheet music for jazz. Jelly Roll Morton sold the first jazz music, sheet music, and so he claimed for the rest of his career that he had invented jazz because he sold the first sheet music of jazz. Well, I just said jazz is improvised. How can that be? You start with that and then you improvise. And so, you know, it'll always be different. Whereas I learned how to play the recorder as a kid, like you probably did. And if we were really good, we played the exact same notes right every time. That was how we were judged for our ability to play the recorder, Baroque music. You all played perfectly. None of you missed a note. In jazz, they wouldn't be playing the same notes. In fact, they mentioned in one of those definitions, occasionally hitting a flat or a sharp where you would hit a regular note, B flat instead of C, something like that. It gives a funny sound. Your brain goes, ooh, that's wrong. And then you're back on the normal melody again. So that's one of the fun things about jazz is it doesn't follow exactly what you think. It may be in 3/4 time, and then all of a sudden they change the time signature or they speed it up or something like that. So jazz is full of surprises. And that's one of the things that people actually really like about it.
So if jazz includes improvisation, and I totally get that, mm-hmm. are there other forms that include improvisation, and would they automatically be jazz, or would they still be this other form?
Oh, they might be adopted by jazz musicians. As I said before, they shamelessly stole from every other genre that's out there. So the history, I mean, jazz, I said 1900 for jazz. It's a good rule of thumb. Although, you know, a couple of decades prior to that, musicians around New Orleans were playing something that began to sound like this. New Orleans jazz being the first one that really came into existence as a genre. And most Americans now know Dixieland jazz, which is New Orleans style. There were periods of revival. So New Orleans jazz, 1910, let's say. 1940s, there was a revival of New Orleans jazz. They called it Dixieland. 1960s, there was a revival of Dixieland again. When you and I moved here to Davis, all of a sudden there was a jazz festival in Sacramento called the Dixieland Jazz Jubilee or Dixieland Jazz Festival. I thought that had been going forever. No, it actually started the year I moved here in 1974. So we're now 70 years away from when New Orleans jazz began, and people are going back and finding those old songs and playing them in that old style, which came to be called Dixieland. The characteristic of that was no one musician in that group would stand out. They would all be playing together as an ensemble. They would, sure, they'd solo for 30 seconds, they'd improvise, but no one stepped forward and said, I'm the leader of this, I'm going to play above everybody else. It was a group thing. Louis Armstrong, Sidney Bechet were playing in groups like that, stepped forward and became soloists. So that became the biggest change in jazz from its inception, was that you had individual musicians who people were coming to see, and the others were their backup musicians. That was a whole new thing. And Louis Armstrong, probably one of the best known jazz figures in American history, one of the most beloved artists in American history through his whole career of over 60 plus years, was the first who did that, stepped forward, played his trumpet in a way no one had ever heard played before, all improvised. Somebody listened to those early recordings of his trumpet playing, carefully wrote it all down, annotated it, sold that music. He got none of this money. Sold that music to every new aspiring trumpet player, goes, wow, this is incredible. I've never heard anything like this before. And pretty soon all trumpet players who played jazz were playing from sheet music, like Louis Armstrong. He had improvised all of that, but he had also done something unusual. He'd created the jazz soloist. And Sidney Bechet, who's less known because he spent most of his career in Europe, much of his career in Europe, similar type of thing. Early 1900s, stepping forward and becoming a soloist.
So where does the word jazz come from? Do you know?
They don't really, that's interesting. There's several theories about that. They first called it jazz, J-A-S-S, which was the term applied to the music by Buddy Bolden. I have read a couple of different bases for where that came from, and I'm not sure which one is accurate, but it was changed from jazz to jazz within just a few years, easier to say, I guess. And it does refer, I think initially it referred to the use of brass in the instruments. So they were taking something and they were adding brass, which was unusual. Ragtime was piano music, basically. So the whole history going back to the beginning, I mean, blues, a lot of people who are really into blues say that jazz came from blues, not directly. Ted Goya's History of Jazz, he basically describes them as co-evolving, but blues was there first. The 1860s, something that we call blues had been identified. By the 1870s, boogie-woogie had been developed in another region. Honky-tonk, another region not far away. Ragtime by the 1880s, and jazz in about 1900. What's interesting about all this music is this is down in the Mississippi River Delta. And it all, if you look on a map, these are all pretty close together by our standards, but they were days and days apart by the standards of the time. You couldn't get from where they were playing blues in the Mississippi River Delta to New Orleans very easily. So they were evolving in the same general region in the rail industry of northeastern Texas. That's where honky tonk came from, or boogie woogie came from. These were not far from each other. So you would imagine that that musicians would cross pollinate, you know, that they would hear one and they'd incorporate that sound into what they were playing in New Orleans. But the key difference is that jazz was an urban music form. Mm-hmm. New Orleans is a city. Jazz started in New Orleans. All the different cultural influences, the French, the Creole, the Africans, very few Europeans other than the French, but the French were a significant influence with that chamber music type of thing. The Latin influence, as we call it, from the Caribbean, all of that was part of the musical mix of New Orleans. That wasn't happening in the Mississippi River Delta where they're doing blues. Now that's a rural music form. Some of the first well-paid music recording artists were blues singers like Bessie Smith. And they when the music industry came along and they were making records, she was paid fabulous sums for the time. I have a record, Bessie Smith singing. She's the star of the record. She's backed up by this little-known trumpet player named Louis Armstrong. So mm-hmm. jazz musicians were backing up blues musicians until ultimately jazz eclipsed blues and left ragtime and boogie-woogie and honky-tonk all behind. They're still there, but they got kind of pulled in to jazz as those musicians adopted those forms.
Okay, this is.
I have an example for you here. Are you ready for some music?
I'm ready for music.
Okay, UB Blake is a piano player that I had the good fortune to hear in concert in the 1970s when he was in his 90s. I didn't actually even know he was that significant when we went to this concert series in San Diego. It was a great pianist concert series. We heard Artur Rubinstein, well-known classical pianist. And then the next concert was UB Blake with a younger guy who was in his 70s named Earl Hines. Jazz lovers will know that that was a phenomenal concert to have been able to see because UB Blake was in his 90s and lived several more years after that. He's older than jazz, right? He's a jazz musician who's older than jazz. He started playing in houses of ill repute as a teenager. And he was a ragtime musician. And then he composed the Charleston Rag. Well, that's played by many, many jazz musicians. So here we go. UB Blake introducing his own composition.
I wrote this, ladies and gentlemen, in 1899. See, I composed it. I always say I wrote it. I could not write music then. I didn't start to write music until I was 15 years old. And I'll play the Charleston Rag. Now, the bass you hear, these people call it boogie. We called it the walking bass. See? Now I play the Charleston Rag. Thank you.
So is all jazz that upbeat? That, I mean, that is sprightly and lively and makes me want to jump up and dance.
Right. And Scott Joplin, who wrote most of the best known ragtime tunes, would have been horrified because he wrote The Entertainer. I have that handy. I'll play it in a part of it in a moment. His liner notes to his compositions, ragtime was composed, there was sheet music for it, said, this is chamber music. This is elegant, refined music. This is not for a house of ill repute. This is for high class people to listen to. This.
Well, they didn't dance, did they?
That's no, high heaven, class people? No, heavens no. They would sit around the parlor and listen to the lovely chamber music. Joshua Rifkin is a very gifted pianist who put out an album of Scott Joplin's piano rags in the 1970s that sparked a whole new resurgence in interest in ragtime. And he followed Joplin's dictate, if you will, to play it this way.
And if I tried to dance to that, it would be very, very hard.
Quite a difference.
Quite a difference, yeah.
And UB Blake went on to become quite well known as a jazz pianist. And you can see what he did to that very elegant chamber music. He punched it up. You'd get up and dance to UB Blake stuff. Scott Joplin, you're going to sit there and listen to the extremely elegant music that was being played. And so that was a big change, was taking ragtime and just basically improvising, going off the sheet music and turning it into something that you could go all over the place with, but it still had that underlying sort of propulsive beat, a bit of a syncopation to it, and the elegance and yet the more primal sounds, I guess you would say, almost of, you know, of dance type music.
There's some terms in those definitions that I read that I wish you would define for me. What is syncopation?
It's a particular type of beat. Most people who know calypso music, Harry Belafonte had a solid gold album with his out record called Calypso, Deo, the very famous song, the Banana Boat song. That's calypso. It has a particular rhythm where an extra beat is thrown in, is the simplest way I can put it. And there was a big rage for samba music and calypso music in the 1950s in the United States, but that stuff goes way, way back. I mean, samba, which was a Brazilian music form, late 1800s, then the 1920s, and then became very popular in the US in the 1950s. Calypso goes all the way to the early 19th century, and again became popular in the 1920s, and then Belafonte put out his record in 1956. Harry Belafonte, who a lot of people know as a folk singer or a world music singer, was interviewed late in his life. He only died a couple of years ago, and he said he was gonna be a jazz singer. But he looked at the field coming in the mid-1950s. He said, it was a little crowded. I wasn't going to compete with Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald. So he went his own direction. He did the music he had grown up with in Jamaica and in the Caribbean of calypso and other music of that sort, which is also very commonly integrated into jazz. I mean, once samba became popular, in 1955, the most popular song, the top of the charts, was a samba song by Perez Prado. I now have in my collection of music probably 50 different songs that have samba as part of the name. They're jazz songs, but because of that danceable rhythm, that specific unique rhythm, it's a really important thing that was imported into jazz in the 1940s and 50s. And ultimately, the best known gentle version of samba is bossa nova. We can talk about that in a little bit. Yeah.
Bossa Nova, I've heard that one.
Yeah, it's a Wikipedia describes it as a relaxed style of samba, which it is. There was one composer in particular, Antonio Carlos Jobim, in Brazil. American jazz artists went down there in the late 1950s. The world music had become incredibly popular. Jazz was waning. Jazz had been the most popular American genre of music across all races. It wasn't just race records as they used to have. Everybody was buying jazz and listening to it and dancing to it. Benny Goodman, I mean, well-known artists were dominating the charts. But by the early to mid-50s, folk music, world music, rockabilly, and ultimately rock and roll replaced jazz. Well, that world music did give jazz musicians an opening. And these jazz artists went down to Brazil, where there's always been this fascinating style of music. The samba in particular went back 100 plus years. They started incorporating that into their own jazz music and came back and released probably the most popular bossa nova album was released by Stan Getz and Charlie Bird in the 1962, blew away the charts and won a Grammy Award, bossa nova. And all of a sudden, a Brazilian sound, but a very soft Brazilian sound, very commercially popular Brazilian sound, based on the compositions of Antonio Carlos Jobim, became very popular in the U.S. Within about 3 to 5 years, almost every jazz musician in the U.S. who was trying to make a living had put out a bossa nova album, some better than others, but it was a style that was commercially successful, very pleasant, danceable. It had that, you know, it had that kind of rhythm. The best known song in it is Girl from Ipanema, which was a huge hit for Jobim and for Astrud Gilberto, the wife of one of the early bossa nova artists. And she had a very breathy tone of voice. She wasn't the most fabulous singer in the world, but she had a very distinctive sound that she launched her career for sure. And bossa nova became a very popular genre in the United States. Jobim's 10 or 12 songs are on almost every one of those bossa nova albums, so he made a fortune on it. And it's a big part of our repertoire now. I mean, almost anybody recognizes Girl from Ipanema or Corcovado or some of the other bossa nova songs because they became so imbued, not just in jazz, but in American sort of soft radio style, the easy listening style, also adopted bossa nova.
Okay. So getting back to jazz, it said, one of these definitions said the 1920s jazz age. Mm-hmm. Did jazz like have a little bit and then just be big and then go back to being nothing? Or is it has it been growing and waning and moving around and still here?
You know, the jazz age was when New Orleans jazz really caught on, and also white Americans started buying records of what we were calling jazz. In the early recording industry, there were race records. There were records that were made and aimed for the African-American community, and records that were aimed at the white community. And jazz had not caught on with the white community, although it was catching on because it was danceable. It was a little naughty. It was had already had the image and reputation of being, I don't know, slightly subversive. You know, when you're supposed to hit a C and you hit a B flat, that's wrong, isn't it? No, it's right. It's jazz. You can do whatever you want. So jazz in the 20s, 10s and 20s was the jazz era. But what came next was swing. And swing, Benny Goodman, King of Swing, that's his nickname. Benny Goodman was the most popular musician in America for several years. When he played Sing, 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 the entire audience jumped up and danced. He would get 10,000 people coming to a concert. Funny thing was, he was a normal musician in his band that was playing sort of normal, what they used to call sweet music at the time, which was not jazz, but for dances. And they adopted swing. And the first place they played it, they were booed off the stage. They thought this had been a disaster. This has been terrible. But they were on their way on train to go out to Los Angeles and play in Los Angeles. Well, guess what was new at that time? Radio. And his swing broadcast that was a complete disaster as far as he was concerned had been broadcast on the radio. When he got to Los Angeles, the crowd was waiting for him with extreme anticipation. And he blew the roof off with this new, then, music. It was called swing. And he became the king of swing. It was Benny Goodman that was asked to have the first jazz concert at Carnegie Hall, which is a legendary jazz concert that meant they'd arrived. In American culture, jazz was now, everybody liked jazz. It wasn't just for that part of the population. Benny Goodman is white. His band was very, very, very popular. Swing was the most popular genre of music for several years, gradually increasing to where we got to big band. That's probably the form of jazz a lot of our parents knew very well. It was the most popular style into the late 30s and into World War II. And it's hard to overstate how much of an impact World War II had on jazz and every other form of American culture, because it essentially disintegrated everything that had been happening up until that time.
When you were talking about these things, wasn't swing mostly instrumental?
Yeah, although there were musicians, and there were vocalists. Early on, vocalists were just in the background. Typically, they were there. There'd be a pretty lady there who was singing. People like Ella Fitzgerald started in the 30s as a singer in a band, people like Billie Holiday and others. And one of the most important things that happened when all the bands were disbanded, where's the term comes from, because of the war, and everything sort of fell apart, and then there was a musician strike, so nobody could record for a couple of years. When the record labels finally got going again in the mid-40s, they were not willing to finance bands. They were not willing to finance orchestras, but they were willing to finance individual vocalists. And Ella
Fitzgerald. There's too many people to pay, is what you're saying.
Yes. The big bands, there were dozens and dozens of big bands in the 30s. And by the end of World War II, Duke Ellington was still around. Count Basie was around. Stan Kent and some of the others that people know the names of. Most of the others were completely gone. Nobody could afford to pay 30 musicians to travel by train from place to place. But they could pay a really good singer to do that. And so you had singers like Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, Frank Sinatra, who had been a jazz singer initially and later became a pop singer. Their record labels were more than happy to keep paying them. But the bands themselves, which had been incredibly popular, you watch World War II movies, they always had big band in the background because that was the kind of dance music people did at the time. My parents were jazz fans because they liked big band and swing. You could dance to it. It was, it was fun. Jazz changed a lot after that. But the soloists, the vocal soloists, became a really important part of jazz.
So if you had a vocal soloist, aren't they still going to need to have musicians behind them? Did they just walk into a studio and say, okay, you five people play this?
Well, there were studio musicians in those days, just like there are now. But typically they had, Ella Fitzgerald fronted her own band for a while after the band leader she'd been working with died. They would typically have their own musicians. But yes, it was a much smaller ensemble. Mm-hmm. My favorite jazz category, if I were having to pick one, would be the small group ensembles of the 1950s. And a lot of that were musicians from the 1940s who had had big old orchestras, Benny Goodman, others, who, because they no record label would pay for them to manage a full orchestra, they'd go into a studio with three or four of their other top musicians and put out really tight, really good albums of jazz with just four or five musicians. That's what it came down to, because the record labels saw that jazz had peaked. It reached, gone past its peak. Record sales weren't what they used to be. They certainly weren't going to pay for 30 musicians to go on the road, but they would pay for a good quality output of a small group ensemble. And some of that small group session type stuff from the 1950s is some of the best jazz around. And it's with names that you might remember from the 30s or 40s, like Benny Goodman and Duke Ellington and others, but they're doing smaller output records. And of course, the long playing vinyl record had come along and they had the opportunity to spread out. They could do more than 3 minutes. The 78 RPM record only went 3 minutes. So every song had to be 3 minutes. Now you had vinyl where you could do a whole side of 20 minutes of one song if you wanted to. So they could be more creative, but there had to be fewer of them. And in some ways it really showcased individual artists more. That's one of the reasons I particularly like that genre of jazz.
Earlier, you were talking and you said that most of the jazz early on was made by and for Black people. Mm-hmm. And then the white folks found it. And
very early, yes.
Very early. And liked it. And it was a bit naughty, you said. Mm-hmm. Now, is that because the words were sexual, or was that because the music was exciting?
Yes.
What was that bit naughty about?
The music was exciting. It caused people to dance in a provocative way. Does this all sound familiar?
Hey, they were around in the 60s, weren't they?
Yes, sir. They were dancing differently than their parents had danced. And there were the big bands, the big orchestras of the time, like Paul Whiteman is a good example. Very, very famous, very well paid, had a huge orchestra, and played music for dances and things like that. you'd recognize minuets and mazurkas and other kinds of 4/4 rhythms and familiar sounds that you could dance to in a large skirt and a full, you know, full dress, whatever you would wear as a male in those days. And it was elegant and slow, and you'd barely touch the other person. And then along comes the jitterbug and the Charleston rag, and music where it's syncopated, so you're going to throw your butt out a little bit as you do it, and you're doing it with someone, you're actually touching them and stuff like that. It was provocative by the standards of the time. Nowadays, it wouldn't look like anything we'd even look at twice, but it was different. People were dressing differently. It was modern, and as such, as always is the case, especially when race is involved, there were people who pushed back against it because they thought it was a bad influence. You'll find all kinds of hilarious newspaper clippings from the time of pastor decries jazz as polluting our youth kind of stuff. Well, more power to it, as far as I'm concerned. If music,
you were here with me in the 60s.
Don. That's right. If music's making you dance in a provocative manner, well, fine. You're getting something out of that music that the musician intended you to get. But yes, it was. It was. And race, the history of race in the U.S. follows jazz and vice versa to a degree that is almost startling. I mean, these musicians were traveling, doing, you know, on the road, doing shows. They went to the South. Bands that had mixed races couldn't play together in many places. If when that finally broke down, they still couldn't stay in the same hotels or eat in the same restaurants. Some of the best jazz musicians went to Europe because they were just fed up with that. Sidney Bechet is a good example, much of his career in Europe for that reason. Louis Armstrong toughed it all out, but there were many, many incidents. Dave Brubeck, who most Californians know because he was here from California, he integrated his band and he had to fight for that in some places they went to play. And he basically said, we won't play unless you allow it. And so that was how it broke down. But that history is there. And so it's all part and parcel of the same story of race in America, playing out with individual musicians, individual bands, as they encountered the Jim Crow laws and the other aspects of Southern, and not just Southern, but American discrimination.
Did you find when you were doing your research on the history of jazz that there was resentment from the groups in New Orleans that started it when a broader population started to play it or use it? Or, I mean, it's like, this is
we started this
music and the white folks has taken over.
Well,
is that resentment in there?
Sure. There's also the other way around. The first recording contract for a jazz group went to the original Dixieland Jazz Band, or Jazz Band, which was a group of Italian Americans in New Orleans. Okay. Who...
Italian American. You haven't spent anything about Italy yet.
Right. The Italian jazz is its own classic genre. But these were Italian Americans in New Orleans who got the first recording contract. And so They went up to Chicago, where the recording industry was, and put out the first album called Jazz. For the rest of their career, they called themselves the original Dixieland Jazz Band. They claim to have invented jazz rather acerbically. As years went by, the leader of that band became actually kind of a jerk about it. But what he really did, because he got mad about other people claiming to have invented, he just took his whole band to England, where they spent many, many years playing jazz and proclaiming themselves to have been the creators of jazz. But as I mentioned, Jelly Roll Morton, who was, you know, ragtime and wrote the first jazz song. So he also claimed to have invented jazz. How do you claim to invent a musical genre? But they both did. And there was a fair bit of controversy about both of those. I would give the nod to Jelly Roll Morton because his was the first sheet music that was sold with as jazz music. But yes, there, that kind of conflict that you're describing was there. It evolved organically. So for anyone to claim to have invented it is a little questionable. Buddy Bolden, historians say, was the first jazz musician. And that's a better approach, is what 30, 40, 50 years later, what people say, this is where it actually began. I would say Buddy Bolden invented jazz, if you want to ascribe it to one person.
Okay. So there's all these Americans who are getting fed up with America and going to Europe.
Yeah.
And so jazz has now been imported. Is it just in England, or is it Germany, France, Italy? Where is jazz going?
All over the world. It is one of our, you know, with McDonald's hamburgers and Nike shoes, jazz is probably, and Coca-Cola, jazz is up there as one of our top exports to the world, in my opinion, the best. It got adopted everywhere. Every country puts its own stamp on it. The French have a very unique style of jazz. They'll have accordions in their jazz bands. Can you imagine that?
The Italians, yeah, I can, actually. Yeah,
sure, any instrument will go into jazz. The Italians have a very distinctive style of jazz, and it's popular all over the world. When the Dixieland Jazz Festival was happening here in Sacramento, bands came from all over the world to play Dixieland jazz here in Sacramento because it had become so popular, especially with World War II. And then after the war, the U.S. government actually encouraged artists to travel, and State Department would fund it for them to travel and promote American culture. And jazz was our main American culture, really, at the time. Louis Armstrong did that more than once. They would go to the Soviet Union. They would go to countries where we were in conflict. And it was always felt that cultural outreach was appropriate. And they were wildly popular. The Dutch are very fond of jazz all over the world. Now, in other parts of the world, there's music. Like I mentioned, samba in Brazil. I mean, that was already there from the early 1800s, and it got incorporated into jazz. But American jazz came down there, and they adopted many of the mannerisms, you might say, and the musical phrasing and the time signatures of American jazz. Brazilian jazz is its own unique thing that's different from samba. And so, and it's very fast-paced and very much dancing community, everybody jump up and, you know, flail your arms around kind of music. It gets a different style everywhere in the world, but American jazz, it's one of our truly great exports because it was so easy to adopt. It's improvisation means you can actually take American jazz styling and apply it to almost any existing music.
Well, now we've come all the way around, back around to the beginning, where so jazz has lots of spin-offs now that you say are still jazz, but other people might say, oh, well, no, that's a different genre now. So that's not jazz anymore. So where do you say the kids are on their own?
Where do you draw the line?
You're all part of this family, but then this rock and roll, that's gone off on its own side. That's no longer jazz. That's rock and roll.
Well, rock musicians do improvise, but it's not the key thing in rock and roll. And they usually use a pretty simple time signature, and they usually don't violate so much the rules of whether you're going to hit a C instead of a B flat. So, yes, the jazz musicians, by the way, have often backed up rock musicians because rock took over from jazz as the most popular genre. But it is different. When I first was listening to music as a pre-teenager, I thought rock music was simplistic to the point of being stupid. My reaction to the Beatles was, these guys are musicians. This is so simple. This is absurd. Now, okay, I'm older now, and I recognize that they were brilliant, and they're an extremely important part of our culture. Still didn't understand why all the girls in my neighborhood were screaming about them, but they were important. But it was totally different than classical music, which I was listening to, R&B music, which my friends and I were listening to, and jazz, which I was starting to listen to at about the age of 12 or 13. Very different. And it was simplistic. A better term would be simple. It really is.
It's simple because they were successful because it was simple.
Yes.
People could understand what was being said, well, except for the accent, and you could hear it and know the melody and know the song. And so that simplicity, I think, was what part of what gave them their success.
Yeah, folk
and
music.
Of course, all of the screaming girls.
Yes. We were young people when the Beatlemania swept the United States, and it was a little scary to watch, honestly. Yes, it's very simple music. It's very straightforward. But here's the thing. Folk music is, too. It's music anybody can sing. And folk music became popular. My parents were big fans of folk music. I listened to a lot of it as a little kid growing up. Late 50s, early 60s, folk music caught on. I mentioned world music had caught on, calypso and things like that, because of the pleasant rhythm as well as the fairly simple lyrics and all that kind of thing. Pretty much anybody could sing along. And rockabilly and rock music came out of that, I guess you could say. And it's a very different style. This was one case where jazz musicians had a hard time. Jazz fell on hard times in the 1960s. Aside from bossa nova, Not very many people were buying jazz albums. Record labels were dropping jazz musicians. Ella Fitzgerald, probably premier jazz artist of life of the time, her record label dropped her because she would only sell 200,000 records of whatever she put out, not a million anymore. She used to sell a million, and now it was dropping. Jazz was no longer as popular as it was. Rock and roll was replacing it. And jazz musicians tried valiantly to play 1960s rock music and folk music and jazz it up. Sometimes that works, usually it didn't, because it's just a very different style. They didn't mesh real well. So that was kind of the end of the road for jazz as we'd known it before. But in the mid-1940s, modern jazz came into being. And that was cool jazz, modal jazz, bebop, soul jazz, a whole bunch of genres that mostly jazz aficionados know. And some of those, like avant-garde and free jazz, were really unsettling to people. Very few people that I know really like to listen to that style of music more than once. So jazz became this esoteric thing. Stephen Colbert on his show before he became the current one he's doing would have jazz musicians on. He had the standard joke, do I have to have a PhD to understand your music? How did the music that came out of the melting pot of New Orleans become this esoteric thing that people thought was cerebral? Well, part of it was that it had lost the recognizable rhythms. There wasn't always a melody you could follow. It was very interesting and unusual, perhaps, but not something you wanted to play when you had people over. So jazz became a rather more cerebral type of music. Finally, late 70s, Wynton Marsalis, some of the other musicians came along who said, well, let's get back to our roots. Let's get back to what we all came from. If someone were to ask me, what jazz musician should I start with to learn about jazz? I would say Duke Ellington.
Okay. Oh, classic. That's a good one. That's everybody, a good one.
Most people know who Duke Ellington is. His career spanned the Harlem Renaissance in the 20s all the way to the 1970s. He went through swing and big band and bebop and all of it. He played with John Coltrane and modern musicians, but he also went all the way back to the 20s and 30s. So you could start with him and go in either direction and learn about jazz. But I know two different people who've gone into a record store, remember record stores, and said, hey, I'm interested in jazz. Who should I listen to? And they would say, Miles Davis and John Coltrane.
That's modern, really early.
No, that's modern jazz. That's 1940s. Oh. That's when jazz got esoteric and really fast-paced and very different. I wouldn't start with that. I'd start with Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, names people recognize, music people recognize from the early 20th century. Then all that other stuff makes sense because you've allowed improvisation to go to full flower. You may have whole songs where you don't even recognize a melody, where they change the time signature 2, 3, 4 times during the song. That's harder to listen to. So you would enjoy it if you had heard the earlier iterations of jazz that preceded that gave it its foundation.
Could you play a bit of music that you would recommend for someone who's just starting out with jazz? You gave me a name, but you said he did all these different things. So give me a song.
Okay. Okay, so that was Duke Ellington. And most people, who are not even jazz fans, have probably heard of Duke Ellington because he had a very long career and he's very familiar. He also is a prolific composer of jazz. And as I say, he's someone that would be a good place to start if you're interested in learning about jazz because his career spanned all those different genres. I encounter a lot of people who don't think they like jazz because they've only heard modern jazz by contemporary artists. Going back and listening to the early stuff would probably give you a better foundation for that. Mm-hmm. And some of it, you know, I'll tell you, the very first jazz musician I listened to was Miles Davis. It happened to be because my friend's older brother was an aspiring jazz trumpeter, and I walked into the room at that house where they were allowed to play music, and he was playing then new, 1968, album, Miles Davis, called Bitches Brew. And it was very unusual, extremely odd. I mean, it was like nothing I'd ever heard before. I said, what is this? I remember this all these years later. What is this? He goes, you sit down. You have to sit down and listen to it. Okay, so that's different right there. You're not jumping up and dancing like swing or big band. Sit down and listen to it. So we listened to that whole side of that album together. And I was fascinated. And I went to the record store. And I was, all right, Miles Davis. I went down to where Jazz was now way down in the corner of the record store because it had fallen on hard times. And I found Miles Davis. And I saw this record called Sketches of Spain, which he did with a symphony orchestra. It sounded like he had an orchestral background. It's one of the great albums of all time, not just jazz. It's one of the truly great music albums of all time. It's got a very much a Latin sound to it, Sketches of Spain. It has Concierto de Aranjuez, which is a fantastic melody that most people recognize actually when you hear it. And it's an astonishing album, and I just went from there. And as a jazz fan from the start, I was collecting artists, not genres. I like Miles Davis. Someone played Ella Fitzgerald. Oh my God, this woman's incredible. So I started buying every record she had put out. I got to say one thing about that. Remember what it was like to try and find music in the 1960s and 70s? You didn't have access to every kind of music in the world.
I distributed music when I had my bookstore in Davis, and I was the distributor for women's music in the central area of California.
You couldn't listen to anything before you... Yeah.
It was a particular... limited group of people whose music was called that. Yep. And so I can totally sympathize with you not being able to find something that you've heard and it's not in the standard record stores.
Right. And then the vinyl was pretty expensive for a kid. That wasn't something you could buy. Now, my brother and sister, who liked whatever the pop top 40 was of the day, could go buy at the brand new store called 7-Eleven records that cost either 25 or 50 cents that were a 45 RPM single record of one song. And they each had a little record player that you could set to play it over and over again. Some of those songs are burned into my brain all these years later, and I detested them, so I won't mention any of them because they're all earworm songs. But that was how you got music, or you listened to the radio. And San Diego was a bit of a radio backwater in those days. There weren't that many radio stations in the San Diego media market, but I had this really cool radio, and late at night you could get stations from LA or even further away, and in would come classical music from Los Angeles or jazz. And so I would, you know, going down the dial, finding this radio station, and oh, this time I can't get it, that time you could. That was how you listened to music. There was no going online and finding 50 bazillion songs you could choose from. You didn't even know if the next record by an artist you liked was going to be any good. It was not uncommon at all for those of us who liked jazz in the 1970s, when jazz had fallen on pretty hard times. I really liked Al Jarreau. He's a great singer, and did a fantastic live performance in Berlin. So I go in to buy his next album. I have no way to listen to it beforehand. I can't even, Rolling Stone existed, but that's about it in terms of any kind of information about it. So I buy it and I take it home. Oh, guess what? Al Jarreau's decided to be an R&B singer now. Well, bye to him. So you don't know. And he spent like 10 bucks on this vinyl. Things were a little different in those days. So if you found an artist you like, you tended to stick with them. And then you might migrate from, let's say, Miles Davis to Jerry Mulligan, who played with Miles Davis, and Jerry Mulligan to Dave Brubeck. Most people know Take Five. Dave Brubeck to Vince Guaraldi, who did the music for the Peanuts TV specials. So that's a good one. So you start sort of finding musicians one by one. And it was a very different process than nowadays, where you can just go onto your computer and go, jazz, and have 47 genres and 10,000 songs to choose from instantly.
And you can play a snippet of the song before you even pay your money.
Yeah, at record stores, there would be a record player that they were playing music on, but they sure weren't playing jazz. They were playing whatever, you know, the Beatles, Barbara Streisand, whatever was popular in those days. You weren't going to walk into a place and hear him playing Ella Fitzgerald, much less Miles Davis.
Well, this has been a great overview about jazz, and thank you for all of the definitions and the summaries and all that stuff. So Don Shore has a jazz show. Tell us about your show, Don.
Jazz After Dark. It is on at 8 p.m. on Tuesdays on KDRT, low power radio station, broadcasting from Davis, California, 95.7. Available by podcast, which seems to be how many people listen to it. Been doing it for many years. I took over from a gentleman who was playing what was called mainstream jazz. Jazz Mainstreams was the name of his show. That would be jazz from the 30s and 40s that follows the pattern we were talking about early on in the show. So I did kind of hew to that to some degree. I felt that I was really wanting to emphasize mid-20th century jazz. I don't play anything by anyone who's alive. I like to joke. People walk in and hand me a CD. Will you listen to my CD? I don't know. I only play dead people. How are you feeling? But then I don't have to wade through a lot of modern jazz. But I focus on those older musicians that I think it's important to keep out there. And I mentioned Duke Ellington, but Count Basie, a lot of the others, and a lot of jazz musicians that have perhaps been forgotten, but who were particularly popular in their time. And so I will focus on a particular genre sometimes, but I almost always, and this is something people who listen to the show don't actually know because I've never announced it, I almost always play the songs in historical sequence.
Ah.
I found that's a really easy way to organize the show, and it almost always works. I may shuffle it a little bit, but typically I'll start with something from the 30s or 40s or even earlier, and then work my way through the 50s and generally finish up with some of the jazz musicians from the 70s and 80s, many cases who are looking back at the roots of jazz music and playing that kind of music again. And I throw other things in there. I mean, I've done several hundred of these shows, so there are some differences. Sometimes I do just a show on bossa nova, for example. But I generally want to focus on the mid-20th century, which is my favorite compliment was one that I got from a listener who said, I didn't think I liked jazz until I listened to your show. And that's an audience that I really want. That's what I found. Going down the radio dial, hit a radio station, it was playing jazz, I stopped, I listened to it, and I was hooked. And that's kind of what we're after.
Well, I want to thank you. This has been Lois Richter with Don Shore today, talking about jazz and all those related topics. So we're going to end the show. This is That's Life, the program, and KDRT LP 95.7 is the station. And let's end this, Don, if you could put a little swing into the wind. That's how we'll end the show.